I love to travel.
And perhaps you like to travel too. There's just something about having new experiences that I just find so captivating. I want to go out. I want to see things that are different, encounter new people, new things, new foods. And the great thing about making a home here in Philadelphia is the fact that I get to discover this city for the first time as a visitor, every time, 3 years into the process. And I'm looking forward to visiting all sorts of neighborhoods. This is a city of neighborhoods, and how grateful it is that we are part of that city. I love leaving my home on Johnson Street and going down, taking the train into Center City and exploring the places just beyond. There's a place called Northern Liberties, Fishtown, Port Richmond, all of these exotic locations, no more than 30 minutes away. And as I ride on the train, I zip past parts of the city, parts that I suspect I will never visit. As I ride the Chestnut Hill West line down, perhaps as you ride the Chestnut Hill West or Chestnut Hill East lines down, you know which parts I'm talking about. You recognize them by the bombed out ruins of factories, by the abandoned houses, row upon row of them in disrepair. And you know, too, that you won't visit those places anytime soon. And that makes me sad. That makes me sad, and I hope it makes you sad too, or at least pause. There are whole sections of this city that are out of bounds. And out of bounds is a prison term. It means a place that is off limits. In fact, if you ever visit a prison, there'll be lines scrawled on the floor painted that say out of bounds, do not cross. There will be consequences, and they will be severe if you trespass these boundaries. We are in a prison because we have places that are out of bounds. Now, if I told you that we were living in a prison, you might think, no, this isn't a prison or a prison state. And if it were, you would want to leave it as fast as you could. Who wants to be behind bars? Who wants to have their movement limited, to be surrounded and monitored by jailers, to be shipped away to an isolated place surrounded by razor wire? No one wants that. And you might think that, no, this is just a place in your imagination, Daniel. No, our lives are not like that at all. But here are other ways that we are imprisoned. We are imprisoned by the fact that no matter where we go, even here, that there are hidden cameras tracking our movement. We are being tracked by our cell phones and our Fitbits and the range of computers and tablets that monitor our precise location whenever we log onto them. We are tracked on social media, where every picture that we take, every click that we make, instantly communicates our precise location in time and space, 24 hours a day. I've never been a conspiracy theorist, but perhaps we might take on the understanding that we are imprisoned by all of the evidence that seems to suggest that we are. Now, anyone who monitors me would be bored to tears, I think. It would just be one epic log of back and forth, church to home, a mere 500 feet apart. It would be an endless stream of contrived cat pictures and obscure tea references and an occasional gem of spiritual wisdom posted on Facebook. But we are living in a prison state, and I mean something entirely different and deadlier. Our actual prison is a spiritual one. It's one without walls and without electronic surveillance. It is one that is created and sustained by us, by a fear of violence in the world and in our community. And the proper name of this prison is called unforgiveness. We would see it written on the gates. This prison is surrounded by a wasteland, and it is a hot desert that dries up all human potential and makes meaningful relationships impossible to have. And we can't expect to grow in a place like that because we are always confined in it. This prison is sustained by fear, real and imagined hostility, chaos. Now, many documentarians, people like Michael Moore, have gone to great lengths to show that violent crime in this country, especially in the cities, has gone down tremendously from a generation or two ago. And even though fewer crimes are occurring in our cities and around the country, the way that they are reported has increased exponentially. We have the 24-hour news cycle, and in order to make the 24-hour news cycle interesting, you have to tell a story, sometimes the same story, over and over again, shocking us with the same horrific stories every hour on the day. And the social media that we spend so much time on does the very same thing. Pictures are beamed to us instantaneously, capturing these moments of terror and sadness. Frightful events are happening all around us, but they're happening at a far fewer rate, but we're hearing about it over and over and over again. It's the kind of thing that would make you want to take a social media Sabbath. And many people are doing just that, creating a movement where they are avoiding the fear-mongering that takes place online and over the airwaves. And perhaps you might consider, too, taking a Sabbath from the bad news. Until fairly recently, the boogeymen that were created by the news industry were often described as shadowy figures from the lower classes, drug users, drug pushers, inhabiting the inner cities, members of dysfunctional and broken families, female-headed households. Oftentimes, and we know this, these were code words for Black or African Americans. People who inhabited the ruins of the industrialized parts of our cities and country. Places like North Philadelphia. And the journalist Ta-Nehisi Coates illustrated this sad state of affairs in the lead article of this month's Atlantic, titled "The Black Family in the Age of Mass Incarceration." Mass incarceration, you see, a term that we've heard again and again here in this congregation, is the result of the hysteria that is generated by the news media. This hysteria that has at its very center the image of a scary Black man undermining society with random acts of violence. And this hysteria, like any hysteria, if you experience it long enough, it numbs you to reality. And that numbing effect that it's had on the majority of Americans, European Americans, has meant that no prison sentence was too long, no act of police brutality too extreme, no consequence post-prison too draconian to curb the rising tide of Black drug use and violence. There was a larger social context for the rise of crime that was seen in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s. But it seemed that large part of it had to do with a shift that occurred in our country and our economy that we were simply not prepared for. The move from industrial production to a service-based economy left many people out. Cities like Philadelphia and Detroit, before the upheavals of the 1960s and 70s, experienced a rise in broadly distributed prosperity. The majority of the population of those places working in the factories that allowed them some disposable income to support the shops that lined the avenues and boulevards. But the rug was pulled out from under them when industrial production was moved overseas. And that left many, many people behind with nowhere to go and nothing to do. And of course, we all know that the black populations were hit especially hard by this. Coupled with racist housing policies, health policies, and educational policies that continue to undermine these communities to the present day. And the unholy solution that Mr. Coates illustrates, and that we know, is that people were relocated en masse from cities to prisons. And these prisons are often located in rural and mineral-rich parts of the country where the raw materials that once fueled the engines of our factories, where they went. And in these rural parts of the state, some of which I've visited, the local whites in this area, in these areas, their only interaction with people of color is in a one-down relationship, jailer and jailed relationship. We've created this prison state, a society of people brought together by fear. And we have a role to play in ending that relationship. You see, people have been, until recently, sent to prison for longer and longer periods for smaller and smaller infractions. And poor and fragile families, those that are left behind, are made to suffer a double punishment. And those who come out of the prisons are punished even further. These ex-convicts, or returning citizens, as we have been taught to call them, are often doubly jeopardized. The work that happens here in this congregation through the Coalition of Mass Incarceration has shown us that when folks come out of jail, they are denied access to basic things that might prevent going into jail in the first place. Things like food stamps and public housings, and even the right to vote in some cases is taken away from them. All of this is a cycle perpetuated by fear and fear-mongering that justifies these draconian approaches. Now, many of us in this room are already familiar with these facts. Again, because of the hard work of people like Marietta Tanner, Kay Weiser, Nancy Anderson, and church friend John Dye Harrell, and others, many, many others. But what you might not be familiar with is the way that forgiveness and the restoration that comes from forgiveness can help us to create a society where returning citizens are treated with their full and human dignity, and where our full human dignity is also restored in the process. We in this room need to be forgiven. Forgiven for the role that we play, complicit in a system rigged to jeopardize the lives of black and brown people in this country. And it's a hard thing to say, but all of us play a part in this. Through our social location, through our spending habits, our voting habits, and more often than not, through our sheer silence in the face of ongoing injustice. We can do more to create the world where the inherent worth and dignity of every person, including those who have made mistakes and acted out of desperation and have served time to amend for their crimes, where their rights and dignities can be upheld. You see, the disparities that we observe every single day are evidence of this overwhelming wrongdoing that is taking place. And the result has left us with ruined cities, hemmed in. And it's created prisons for us by creating places that are simply out of bounds, places that remind us of the stark and clear boundaries between those who have and those who have not. And we are separated by fear, And it's the fear that leads to violence, not the other way around. Now, it's almost irrational to say that peace, the peace that we all seek in this world and in our society, could begin with forgiveness. It's counterintuitive. But at this point in our evolution, it's the only thing that we have left. If we continue as we have been by scapegoating certain parts of the population, by applying this eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth methodology, we will continue to go nowhere fast. In our system of logic, wars are supposed to bring peace, punishments are supposed to establish order, domination assures material progress, subjugation keeps the family in proper order. Blaming brings peace. But we know that that is absolutely false. And continuing to apply those methods creates deserts without end. If we ever have any hope for peace among communities and within communities, if we ever hope to have peace among races, nations, sects, religions, it has to be built on a foundation of forgiveness. The writer Robin Kasargian describes forgiving groups as groups that see beyond perceptions and beyond hostile imaginations, that sees individuals anew. Let us see individuals and communities anew. Let us step out of the worlds created by hostile imaginations, by fear-mongering. Let's turn it off. The war on drugs, mass incarceration, the achievement gaps, these can only be resolved through an encounter with the other and on terms of forgiveness. And the kind of forgiveness that we require and that Kasargian, this writer and expert on forgiveness that she recommends, is one where we acknowledge the ways that we have been acting out of fear and make a commitment to change that narrative. The Nobel Prize laureate Desmond Tutu describes how he counsels forgiveness, and the reason why he counsels forgiveness is because oppression dehumanizes the oppressor and the oppressed. In this prison state that we are living in, we are all oppressor and oppressed. So let us change that story. Let us change our locations, both in time and in space. Let us return to those well-watered places. Let us recreate gardens out of deserts. Restoration will come. We will be able to tend the tree of life if we become good witnesses, acknowledging our wrongs, acknowledging the fears, and changing the stories. We are all called to be restorers of the breach, restorers of streets to live in, all streets to live in. Imagine what kind of world we might recreate as we're riding down into the city, past lush gardens, restored buildings, and factories that have found new purposes. Forgiveness reminds us that we get to choose how the story ends. And it reminds us of the possibility of healing and restoration. May it be so, and amen.